Hello and welcome to Overinvested, a podcast about pop culture obsessions. I'm Gavia Baker-Whitelaw, and here is this week's co-host, Claire Biddles.
Hello.
So in an abrupt turn from last week's blockbuster episode on Dune Part 2, we are here with a report from the Glasgow Film Festival, which will include our review of Love Lies Bleeding, the already iconic gory and sexy horny lesbian movie starring Kristen Stewart and Katie O'Brien. But we also have a very broad spectrum of current and future indie releases to discuss. We're not discussing every film we watched because there were many, but I feel like we've got a really cool lineup for us today.
Yeah, it's a good spread for sure. And I think definitely representative of our respected tastes and their overlaps.
And you are also like the queen of the Glasgow Film Festival, so it's very funny to watch a movie with Claire at Glasgow's like little cool indie theatre. Every time we have been, you have bumped into 10 to 20 of your immediate friends on the way in or out of the movie.
It's true. I used to work there and still do some bits of work for them. It's like a combination of everybody who works at the cinema. Hello to my friends, shout out to my friends at the GFT and everybody else who's coming to see whatever film I'm coming to. So it's usually just like, and also like, it's been quite a chaotic time in my personal life. And I had just also come off a flight from America. So I was really knackered when I came to Glasgow Film Festival this year. And I was just immediately like, here's everybody I have ever known. But it was very good.
So I think the first movie we're going to talk about is one of yours that I did not see. And I think I was just like, this is really long, so I'm going to wait for other people's opinions. But this is a highly acclaimed and hyped European indie film.
So it's Do Not Expect Too Much from the End of the World, which is the new film by Rado Jude, who directed, amongst other things, Bad Luck Banging and Loony Porn from the other year, a Romanian filmmaker who is known for quite freewheeling films that are also like commentary on geopolitics and specifically Romanian society. And this film is, I think it's about 3 hours long. It's shot in black and white and colour, as are so many films in vogue at the moment, and follows like a gig worker played by Ilinka Manolak. So I didn't like the film, but she's really good in it. And she plays a gig worker who is tasked with finding people to audition for a film about injuries in the workplace. It's very like, it kind of doesn't really matter what it's about, but she's kind of going around, and she also has this like TikTok persona that she does where she's kind of like pretending to be this like brash kind of misogynist guy on TikTok. So she's kind of recording these TikToks, and then it goes between that and then like these people that she's speaking to, and all of these people are kind of in poverty, and she's kind of skint herself and like trying to kind of make money. And I kind of felt, the whole thing felt like, I get it. You know, like the first 15 minutes I was like, I get it. And then it just kept going. The stuff that I'd read before I went into it was kind of saying that it was going to be like super intelligent and have all of these different references to the modern world. And I quite like something that's like a big state of the nation film that feels like we didn't start the fire. But this to me was like the most obvious bits of that. And I kind of felt almost like I was missing something because, you know, when you're just like, am I thick that I'm not getting this? But it's on general release soon in both the UK and US. I think it's already been out in some place in Europe. So I'd be really interested to kind of read more about it. It's one of those films where, like, even though I didn't like it, I'm glad I saw it, because there's certainly like going to be a lot of chatter about it. It already won, I think, the Cahiers du Cinéma number one film in 2023, and it came high on like the Sight and Sound list. And
yeah, it was one of those movies that was featured really high on a lot of best of lists last year. And I was like, this doesn't count because normal people aren't allowed to watch it yet. It's not out anywhere anyone could see it.
I always think that. And it's like, it's not, I just don't think it's fair to do that. But also another reason for me to be disappointed in the film was that the first still that I saw from it was a picture of Nina Hoss in like a Zoom meeting looking like with this fake background behind her, and it kind of looked like she was like the Wizard of Oz in the way, you know, like this like demon big face. And so I got excited that Nina Hoss was going to be in it. She's one of my favourite actors, and she's in it for I think about 9 minutes total, and it's a 3 hour long film.
No, so. they've done the criminal crime of marketing a film based on their only famous cast member. Famous being quite a stretch with it being Nina Hoss, yeah. But I understand. Yeah.
So any other Nina Hoss stands out there, and I know that you're definitely out there, just be warned.
You can watch the 10 minute TikTok supercut as the filmmaker intended. Exactly. Yeah, I think even though, like, obviously we don't love and hate all the same movies, your specific review to this has kind of put me off. I don't know if I'm going to see this one. But yeah, the next one on our list is one of mine. The Glasgow Film Festival is attached to Fright Fest, which is a British horror festival, which I always go to. And I watched many films there. I've selected a few of my faves, one of which is the movie Sleep, directed by Jason Yu. It's a South Korean film. And it stars Jung Yoo-mi and Lee Sun-kyun, and that's his final film. He was one of the actors from Parasite, and he passed away this year. This is kind of a horror comedy, but not in the sense that an American horror comedy would be sort of a parody. It is a horror movie that's funny. I was absolutely cracking up and also screamed multiple times during this film. It's so fucking fun. The concept is that the main characters are a young married couple, and they are expecting a baby. So the wife is heavily pregnant. The husband, who is a kind of jobbing actor in small roles, suddenly starts to have sleepwalking symptoms and starts acting really dangerously in a way that's very scary and like excellent fodder for jump scares. So they try and figure out what's wrong with him. You know, they take him to the sleep doctor and stuff. And it's just an extremely entertaining version of like several different horror tropes, like, what if your husband started acting really scary when you were in a relationship and you were trapped with him? And also, isn't it spooky when people sleepwalk? And the you know, the ambiguity of whether something is supernatural or medical, but all shot in a really funny and witty and not subversive, but kind of subverting some genre norms and structured in a really fun way without being a sort of artsy movie. It's just a really well-constructed horror film that I enjoyed enormously and just like is fun and exciting all the way through. And it was selected by Bong Joon-ho as one of the best debut films he'd ever seen, which is quite a quite a good review. That's kind of why I saw it, because I saw that he was hyping it up and I was like, I'll go check it out. And he was correct. So Sleep, directed by Jason Yu, I can definitely recommend.
Yeah, I'm excited to see that for sure. And definitely after your review. And my friend Josh, who's also kind of a big Korean cinema person, was super into it as well, so I'm very excited. The next one that I want to highlight is Opus, which is a concert film of Ryuichi Sakamoto, the composer, electronic music pioneer, who sadly passed away last year. One of my personal musical heroes. You maybe know him for his many, many solo records or his work with Yellow Magic Orchestra, but listeners to this podcast will probably most know him for his soundtrack work, famously Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, which he also starred in with David Bowie, all the way up to Monster, which is the new Koreeda film, which he scored, and that was his last score, but he's very prolific in the world of scoring. But this was billed as his last performance. Basically, he had cancer, he knew that he was going to die, and he recorded his last album, 12, which is incredible, which came out beginning sort of around this time last year. And the concert is kind of a lot of songs from that, but also his kind of reworkings and revisiting a lot of his like older works, which are some of them like more obscure and some of them super famous, like the Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence theme, which if you heard it right now, you'd recognize it straight away because it's been in like a ton of other films and adverts and TV and stuff like that as well. It's a really beautiful film. I'd actually seen bits of it, which were in a kind of live stream when his album 12 came out. So it was kind of I watched that on my laptop screen and wanted to, was really excited to see it like in a cinema with a good sound system as well. And it's just a really moving performance. I'm a mega fan of Sakamoto, so can only speak from my perspective of really loving him. And I think everybody in this screening was also somebody else who's like a big fan. But I think that non-fans would also kind of get the kind of significance of it. It's a beautiful performance. And it was also notably directed by his son, Neo Sora, who's also filmed a bunch of his other performances as well. A very beautiful document of his final performance. I think that's also on general release pretty soon as well. So very much recommended.
Yeah, he's one of these kind of iconic figures who I'm completely unfamiliar with, but people love this movie. I think I might check it out just as someone who, just out of pure ignorance, as someone who just loves music. So
there was also a documentary about him a few years ago called Coda, which is really exceptional. I think it's on Criterion and Mubi right now. And I think that and this both getting a cinema release kind of, I hope that people who didn't really know that much about his work would like check it out after that. I think you'd really dig him actually. So
I think I probably would.
You should definitely see it.
I love, you know, I like music. Basic comment, but true. So the next movie we're discussing is one that is coming out on general release quite soon and is going to be a big indie hit. It is La Chimera, directed by Alice Rohrwacher, who is an Italian film director who's made various movies, including Heavenly Body and Happy as Lazaro. I saw her short film Le Pupil, which is on Disney Plus if you have Disney Plus. It's also, by short, I mean 40 minutes long, and it's just a really delightful movie about like a girl's school. This film is less delightful, but very stylistically recognizable if you've seen any of her other work. It is an Italian drama set in the 1980s, and it stars up-and-coming British icon Josh O'Connor, who is about to become extremely famous because he's in that tennis movie with Zendaya. But you may know him as Charles in The Crown also. And he's in, you know, God's Own Country, the beloved depressing gay drama. Yeah. But in this, he is playing an archaeologist who is sort of embroiled in this criminal gang who are robbing ancient Roman graves in Italy and then selling the grave goods. And watching this was such an interesting experience for me because that description, for some reason, I was like, this is going to be sort of like a chirpy little romantic heist movie. It's like, it is not. This man is miserable and unpleasant, but in a really fun way. Obviously, Josh O'Connor is a fantastic actor and it is such a precise piece of character work right from the very beginning. I really don't want to give that much away because it's one of those films where it just, the experience of discovering what the film is about is just so artistically pleasurable. Not in the sense that it's a twisty kind of film because it's very much like an indie drama about idiosyncratic characters in a very specific setting. I would say don't see this if you're really tired because I saw it on a Friday night after like a long week of doing whatever it was I was doing that week. And I was kind of like, I can't entirely focus on this at first. It took me a while to get into it. But once I did get into it, I was just like, Alice Rohrwacher is amazing. The cast in this is so fantastic. Isabella Rossellini is in it in a minor role, but everyone else is actors who I couldn't really recognize, like minor Italian actors in this group of like very kind of eccentric, normal looking people in this small town whose job is petty crime. And the way they interact with each other as a group is just so well directed and entertaining, but also it's a bit of a dark story. And there's so much kind of juicy material going on there thematically that you will have to watch the film to find out. But I really liked it. And I just wish that my brain had been slightly less exhausted when I was watching. Did you see this one?
I didn't see it. This was one that was like super hyped at the festival. And I think like it was like a pretty big deal that they'd gotten it. And I knew a lot of friends who were going, but I didn't get a ticket. I think I didn't know if it would be stylistically my thing, but then everybody was kind of hyping it afterwards. So like, I am definitely going to see it. And I do really like Josh O'Connor. I kind of felt a little bit of FOMO after everybody went to see it and said that it was amazing. But
yeah, it's so incredibly original. And I was just, it's one of those movies where I was just watching it and I was like, there is absolutely no way I could do this. Obviously, like, I don't know how to direct a film and I'm not the kind of person who's like, oh, I could totally paint that painting like a 4-year-old, you know. But it's just the specificity of Alice Rohrwacher's vision is just really impressive and unique and shows like such kind of emotional intelligence, I guess, in a way that's just really kind of witty and quirky, but not quirky in a Wes Anderson way.
Yeah, because I think that was what I was worried about, was the quirkiness, and because you know I'm allergic to quirk.
Yeah, it's not so. It's not like that. It's enough about like a depressing young man that you'd be into it, I think. Chain smoking and being dour.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. You know what I like.
Okay, I think it's time for us to talk about our headliner, which is Love Lies Bleeding, directed by Rose Glass, previously director of St. Maud, which was my favourite movie the year that came out, horror movie St. Maud. But now she is being catapulted to international stardom because every lesbian in the world and lesbian adjacent individual has to see this film by law.
Truly. Otherwise they kick you out. I imagine that there's a lot of lesbian and lesbian adjacent people listening, so you probably know what's happening. And it's been getting an awful lot of like very steamy press. But it's starring Kristen Stewart and Katie O'Brien as two lesbian and lesbian adjacent people in a gym. Kristen Stewart works in the gym. Katie O'Brien's a bodybuilder.
Crucially set in small town 1980s America.
Crucially, with all of the outfits that you would expect. A lot of her outfits gave me like Iron Claw vibes. Like,
yeah, the press around this being very gym centric is absolutely valid, but it's always really funny with like the kind of photo shoots that are putting Kristen Stewart in the gym, because it's like this woman is made of noodles, whereas Katie O'Brien, her co-star, they cast this by putting an open call out for bodybuilders, being like, we specifically want a bodybuilder. And she tweeted in being like, I'm a bodybuilder, and then found someone to put together a PowerPoint presentation about all her talents, and she knocks out the park. She's fantastic.
She's really, really
but like
good.
The relationship is between this small town working in a shitty job lesbian played by Kristen Stewart and this bodybuilder who hitchhikes into town, starts working out at the gym, and is looking for a place to stay. And Kristen Stewart becomes so horny instantly that like she just completely blows up her life. And it's this, we don't want to spoil it at all, but it is a crime thriller. It's a very kind of just absolutely schlocky. It's like a B-movie schlock extravaganza, post Tarantino, very horny, very sweaty, very fun.
Very fun. Just great trash and a true tribute to U-Hauling. We went to the opening gala. This is the opening gala of the festival, and there was a lot of knowing laughter at, like, a lot of
every anecdote from people watching this movie is just like going to the theater and every other person there is also a lesbian.
Yeah, it was really great. Like, I went with my friend who, I'm bisexual, not a lesbian, I'm more lesbian adjacent, but I went with my friend who is straight, but she did wear a sleeveless t-shirt in tribute. She was like, well, I've got to pay my respects. The atmosphere, you could cut it with a knife. It was great. And the director, Rose Glass, did a really good Q&A afterwards as well. And one of the producers was talking about how fun it was to film it. And a really great anecdote about how Ed Harris, who plays Kristen Stewart's father, not very recognizable at first because he's got this like long hair, ponytail, kind of greasy.
Yeah, see, he's got Legolas length hair, but he's this scumbag who, you know, works out of a trailer at a gun range.
Yeah, and she was like, "Oh yeah, Ed Harris provided his own wig. He chose his own wig for the film."
I mean, it was a really delightful little anecdotal thing because it was, I think he's married to a makeup artist or a hairdresser or something, so she put him in an extra long wig, and the way they do it is, they put you on a light wig and then they cut it down to size. And then the director was just like, no, the length of the original wig is actually great. Let's keep you with just waist length hair. And he is kind of unrecognizable, even though we all know Ed Harris. And it's a proper Ed Harris role. Like, he does have a selection of roles that he does quite a lot. And I think he probably really enjoyed getting to do that. But also the really funny thing is they were joking about how he actually looks a lot like Kristen Stewart's dad, because they were looking at photos of Kristen Stewart's dad. And it's like, he did have, like, this hair.
So funny. Another bit of casting in this film, which I thought was amazing, was Jenna Malone as Kristen Stewart's sister, which, I mean, I love Jenna Malone in absolutely anything.
Absolutely adore her.
Have seen a load of shite that Jenna Malone has been in just because she's been in it. But I think, inspired sibling casting. Because they look really alike, but then also, like, their chemistry as siblings is so believable. And Jenna Malone's kind of the, like, straight in both terms of sexuality and kind of straight-lacedness counterpoint, like, older sister.
And the styling is really fun because obviously this movie wouldn't have happened 10 years ago, but 10 years ago, Jenna Malone would be the kind of actor you'd get in the Kristen Stewart role. And in this, they've like fully restyled her to be this 1980s housewife, working class housewife with kind of bouffant blonde hair and these like horrible outfits and stuff. So it's great. I mean, I think we both rated this like 3.5 stars on Letterboxd.
Yeah. It's a true 3-star film, 5-star experience.
High level of entertainment value. I know lots of people are like, this is the greatest film of the year, and I respect that opinion. I was just like, this is like a fun, trashy time at the movies. I love that it exists. I love Kristen Stewart, as any regular listener will know. I fucking love Kristen Stewart. And I'm happy she did this. And I'm also very excited to see more movies by Rose Glass. I found her first film a lot more interesting, but I always find it really exciting when a new, really original filmmaker just does like really different things with each project. Because this is kind of proving that, yeah, she can do like a really diverse range of stories and tones, but also this has the same kind of effect as a lot of parts in St. Maud, which is shock laughter, you know? Because there's stuff that happens in this that's so fucked up, but it's so entertaining and funny.
Yeah.
And Kristen Stewart's funny.
Kristen Stewart is really funny.
She's so funny.
People forget this about her. And another thing that I liked about it was that Rose Glass is is British, and St. Maud was set in, it was filmed in Scarborough, which I didn't know when I went to see it, and I thought it was American. So when it was in Scarborough, it was a big shock. But she does Americana so well, and I loved that. That was like part of the surprising, fun nature of it. It's like, wow, you've really committed to this. Really loved it. Unless we forget that there's a lot of lesbian stuff in St. Maud as well.
Yes. St. Maud is obviously quite a lesbian adjacent movie, and this one is just like the gayest film you've ever seen in your life. Before we move on to the other film, I would just like to note as a postscript to your comment about Americana, there was another really funny detail from the Q&A, which is like some person asked her, like, why do you select this location to be where the film's set? And I can't remember, it's like New Mexico or something.
Yeah, I think so.
And she and her producer were both just like, obviously the tax breaks. Like, we, of course, we selected this location because of the tax breaks. And then by extension, any place that has good tax breaks for filmmakers has a pre-existing crew that you can hire from the next town over. And it's like, yeah, that often is the reason. It's like, why does everything film in Georgia?
Just a really inspiring place, you know.
The next film is one that I actually wanted to see and didn't get around to. Please tell me, Claire, about The Vordalak.
Gav, you're gonna bloody love this film. Speaking as a bisexual woman, I will go and see anything with vampires. And this is a vampire kind of, it looked from the stills, it looks like really kind of like weirdly stylized, very kind of theatrical almost. It's shot on 16mm, so it's got that kind of grainy texture to it as well. And it's based on a proto-Dracula vampire story. And it's about this French aristocrat who gets knocked off a horse and then happens upon this creepy family, and one of them's a vampire and creepiness ensues. It's just like a really good putting a hapless man in a situation and then seeing what happens kind of thing. It's directed by Adrien Beau. It's a French film. It's his first feature, and interestingly enough, he used to be a theatre designer and he was a clothing designer. He worked for John Galliano, among others. And it was really, really cool. I was like, great past lives there. And then went on to make a couple of like horror shorts and then this one. But I think that kind of background in design really, really comes through because the design elements of the film are so top notch.
I heard this one has some like weird effects or prosthetics or something.
Yeah, so basically the vampire is a puppet.
Love it.
Best puppet since Annette. And it made me think of the bit where Robert Pattinson is talking about Twilight and about how they Google vampire baby. It made me think of vampire puppet. So the whole way through, I was thinking about that. The tone is like, this is kind of a bit weird and a bit kooky in a kind of French Peter Strickland-y type way, or like a kind of Yorgos Lanthimos-y kind of, you know, like a bit of a kind of heightened winking kind of thing. But the puppet is like very gracefully done and very, very creepy, much like in Annette, which one of my favourite films of that year.
I can only apologise. I made it one third of the way through Annette and then I was like, I can't do this anymore.
Listen.
But this is the thing. I thought I would love a movie that is Adam Driver and what's her name in a puppet. I was like, I'm going to love this. And it's like, I'm dying. And I loved Holy Motors.
Listen, if it's not for you, it's not for you.
No.
Also, shout out to my friend Steph, who went to see that film with my other friend April. And Steph didn't know that it was going to be a puppet. Which I think is the best way to explain.
I would be thrilled to watch a movie and find out that a character is unexpectedly a puppet. I would be delighted.
I didn't know that this vampire was going to be a puppet, but it's the kind of film where it's not that surprising.
Yeah.
It's a bit, it's kind of like, well, this film is quite like
this. I love how we opened this podcast with you being like, I don't like it when things are quirky. It's like, unless it's a vampire. Unless it's a 16mm European drama with a puppet vampire.
Listen, that's the kind of quirk that I can get involved with. But yeah, Vodalek, very, very fun. It's got a real standout performance from Ariane Labed, who has been in loads of Yorgos Lanthimos films. She's married to Yorgos Lanthimos. She was in the film Attenberg. She's a Greek actress and she plays the spinster sister in the family, and she is giving a real, like, at times quite kind of unhinged performance, but like also quite enigmatic in different ways as well. And once you get to the end, you kind of realize that it's quite a well done allegory about patriarchal control, both in like the way that her character of the sister and her kind of gender non-conforming brother are kind of controlled by the vampire puppet father, but also in like the way that they, again, harking back to this guy's past as a designer, also in the way that the costumes are done as well. So it's like, it kind of focuses really tightly on this allegory and does it really well, I think. But it's also just like a really enjoyable 90 minutes. The music's really good as well. And just like, it's just very well crafted.
I love that that's what Yorgos Lanthimos' wife is doing while Yorgos Lanthimos is getting 12 Oscar nominations for a less intelligent sounding film.
Exactly. I'm like, babe, you made the right decision.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, if your husband's loaded, then it's so much easier to stick around in the better and more interesting films of the European industry. So
go for it, girly. Your next film is one that I actually had a ticket for, but couldn't make it in the end. So I am very excited to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, so this is The Beast, which is going to be a very big indie sci-fi release this year. It's coming out in a couple of weeks. This is the only movie I got an actual review to publish for from the festival, because no one's publishing reviews anymore. But if that's up, I'll link to it in the show notes. But this is a French film directed by Bertrand Bonello, who is a very well-established French mainstream but indie director who did films like the biopic of Yves Saint Laurent and the film Nocturama. I have never seen any of his other films, but he is extremely well-known and successful in France. He's sort of one of these people who started out doing like very scandalous films and is now middle-aged and is part of the establishment. It's funny to look at his Wikipedia page and see that he had complaints and censorship from the government body that has since given him a knighthood.
Yeah, that feels right. Yeah. I've seen a number of his films and thinking of the trajectory, that seems very right.
Yeah. So this is a, I would say, cross-genre sci-fi film. It stars Léa Seydoux, icon, in the main role. And then George MacKay is the secondary lead, who is her kind of love interest character. And the way this is described in kind of, you know, you Google it, IMDb, all the promo materials, the premise is that the story kind of revolves around this near future technology that allows you to contact your past lives. And the purpose is that it's this kind of dystopian future where people want to dull down their emotions by, you know, reacquainting themselves with past traumas and then kind of erasing and smoothing down that memory. So it's kind of an allegorical therapy sort of concept. It's also very familiar within sci-fi. There's movies like Equilibrium, that film with Christian Bale, where they're like, we're going to kill emotions with future antidepressants. And it's basically like a ripoff of The Matrix. God love it. There's a lot of stories like that. But that really makes it sound a lot more sci-fi than it actually is. It's a lot more kind of philosophical, experimental, and it takes place in three time periods. So the parts that are actually with Lea Seydoux's character in the future are like 10% of the film. A lot more of it takes place in the 1910s in Paris with like an earlier incarnation of her character. It is an adaptation of a Henry James story from like 1905. What? Yeah, it's wild, right?
I have no idea about that.
Right. So there's this book called The Beast in the Jungle, which Henry James wrote, which is essentially a romantic drama about anxiety. The main character is this person who has this kind of obsessive sense of foreboding that kind of ruins his life because he's convinced that something bad's going to happen. So he has an anxiety disorder, basically, but in a very French and artistic way. And it's, you know, metaphorical or whatever. But this movie is like, what if we kind of took that concept, gender flipped the main character, added science fiction, and made it in three timelines? So
sure.
The way in which this is even technically an adaptation is just like, I mean, you could easily just say it's not, but like the titular beast is also very funny that they were allowed to keep this title because it is not a movie about a beast, except in the sense that Lea Seydoux's character, throughout each of her different timelines, does have this sense of foreboding, which you can interpret in like a variety of different ways, because it's like, of course, you know that somewhere in the future of her kind of, you know, psychic reincarnation, something bad's going to happen. But also there's different things that are bad that are happening in each of these other incarnations, the third of which takes place in 2014. And in each of these lifetimes, she meets George MacKay's character, or possibly George MacKay. In Scotland, it'd be George MacKay. I don't know how you pronounce his surname. He is the actor from 1917. And I do think he's a pretty good actor, but in this, he didn't fully win me over because I feel like in order to have a kind of immortal reincarnated romance, you need to really sell him as a sort of passionate, obsessive love interest in the same way that Lea Seydoux is really passionate and obsessive in this. She is obviously incredible at that, and she has played a lot of roles that are quite vampy, I guess. Like most recently, she's in Dune Part 2 as the fantastic character Margot seducing the bald freak man. Very fun. But she is obviously knocking this role out of the park, and it's also this very intense role because she has to be like terrified of stuff that isn't there. You know, the first scene of the movie, just to like make sure that the audience is in the correct kind of art cinema mindset, it takes place in a green screen soundstage, and it's unclear whether it's Lea as herself or Lea playing the actress she plays in 2014. Right, okay. And she's sort of reacting to this monster that's not there, and then it's like, okay, well the next half hour of the film is going to be in 1910. Which is delightful. So like, this is definitely a movie where like there was a lot of parts that I was really enjoying. There's a lot to kind of dig into thematically, but I think it kind of hinges on how invested you are in George MacKay's as the mirror image half of this romance. Because the friend I went to see it with, she was like, oh, he's so amazing. Like, it was so romantic. And I was like, was it? So clearly it's a matter of opinion.
Okay, interested too.
Yeah, the music's really cool. Bit of Nepo baby info is that Bertrand Bonello's daughter is apparently a composer because they composed the music for this together. So there's like a really kind of cool combination of anxiety-inducing techno and sort of classical music because her character in 1910 is a pianist and is playing this sort of early 20th century, you know, Schoenberg and stuff. Yeah, I just find this a really interesting film. Ooh. I think the fact that it's going to be marketed as like a, go see this indie sci-fi film, it's like, well, you should. But it's a lot weirder than that describes. It's definitely like, I was thinking of Holy Motors quite a lot when I was watching it.
Oh my God, okay.
Yeah. It's like a less extreme Holy Motors vibe. But I was definitely like, this is a rewarding experience, even though some parts were kind of goofy.
Amazing.
Also, they keep switching aspect ratios, which is always funny.
Yeah, I'm always like, okay.
I'll allow it.
You really made a choice there. Speaking of making choices, does George MacKay speak French in it?
Yes, he does. He learned French for it. So it was originally going to star Gaspard Ulliel. Very kind of beloved French actor who is about the same age as Lea Seydoux, but he died right before filming was about to start. So they had to recast it very rapidly. And after I finished this out, I was like, that's interesting, because it would have been an entirely different vibe, you know, because Gaspar Ulliel, like this very, very handsome actor, obviously French. So it would have been a different dynamic, because it would have been two French characters rather than a French character and an English character. George MacKay's character is an English character who sometimes speaks French.
Right.
In one timeline, he's American, that sort of thing. Because he looks younger than Leia. There's this sort of thing where it's like, she is this sort of, looks like she's in her mid-30s, has this very sort of mature vibe, and he looks more boyish, even though he's only like 5 or 10 years younger than her.
Yeah.
But also he's quite like awkward looking. So there's always like a different dynamic between like two people who are super hot and like one person who's super hot and one person who's just like normal hot.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, he has got like a funny...
He has this very strained face. Like he's very kind of tight. He's got unique features, which is like good for an actor, but it changes the dynamic, you know, and it also, you know, changing the nationalities. So the fact that it was written for two people kind of did maybe put him like on a different footing, but they intentionally wanted to cast someone who was very different to avoid comparisons with Ulliel.
Yeah. Oh, I'm really interested to see it. I can't wait. I was gutted that I couldn't go. Very much anticipating it. So the next one that I want to highlight is a film that I had never heard of until I booked it, which is We Have Never Been Modern. The festival had a Czech strand, and this one stood out to me as it's a period film set in the 1940s. The stills and the poster made it look very stylized, which it is. And it's about a couple, one of them's pregnant and is kind of waiting for this baby to come, and the other one kind of heads up this company in mid-century Chechnya. And the kind of world is shook, both the couples and this community that they live in, when an intersex baby is found in the factory that the guy runs. So it's like a very unusual plot, especially for a period film. Obviously, I watch a lot of queer films, but I couldn't think of many films that I've seen with intersex characters at all. Yeah. So the fact that the focus was on like an intersex child, that basically like it's implied that this child has been abandoned. And then like, obviously in the 1940s, knowledge about intersex people and bodies, it was even less than it is now, which is still like not that much. It's also kind of like a mystery film. I read something that the director said before making it, the director's Matej Chulpacek, which is probably pronounced very much differently, who is a kind of big Czech filmmaker. And they said that they wanted to make a film that was about a detective, but it wasn't somebody who's professionally a detective. So like basically this main female character who's played by Eliska Krankova, who's amazing in it and is like very striking looking as well. She is kind of playing this role of this detective, but she's this like heavily pregnant woman who is kind of a housewife. It's also like got loads of really interesting stylistic details. There's like a lot of like kind of titles that come up over the film that are kind of very stylish and add to this almost like chocolate boxy type vibe of the town that they live in and the community that they live in. The costumes are incredible. When you're first watching it, you realize that the main character is being dressed in like a different color from all the rest of the characters who are all dressed in the same color, but it's not, you don't really know why. And it's like all of these like kind of strange stylistic elements that really add to this feeling of unease, but they're all also quite period correct as well. So it's like really,
that sounds
weird.
Fascinating. I'd never heard of this.
Yeah,
I would definitely like to see that.
I actually made loads of money in Chechnya, but this guy's like more famous and had a big budget and stuff like that. But I hope that it gets more of a release here, because it was just like a really fascinating thing. And yeah, an unexpected premise and an unexpected kind of way of dealing with a lot of the things that it was dealing with. So yeah, really recommend trying to seek that out. We Have Never Been Modern. Good title as well.
Yeah. All right. We have one final film, which is All You Need Is Death. Claire, did you see this?
No, but I really wanted to see it, and I only didn't see it because it was clashing with something else.
You're going to love it.
How could I not with this premise? I swear to God.
God, it's so good. 2024 is clearly going to be such a good year for horror. There's already so many kind of buzzy, small horror movies. I always have my little fingers on the pulse of this shit. This is one of the films I was really, really looking forward to this festival. It's an Irish indie horror film filmed on quite a small budget, directed by a man named Paul Duane, who has not directed a fiction film before, but has done some documentaries, including music documentaries. And Claire also noted in our notes for this episode, oh, he created Secret Diary of a Call Girl. And I was like, that can't be right. So I looked it up, and what it is like he was the co-owner of a production company that initially bought the rights to the blog for Secret Diary of the Call Girl.
Right.
Like, he must have done the early draft that got it on TV, and then someone else made the TV show with Billy Piper. Yeah, it was,
that is wild.
It's a wild IMDb credit, but I think that's what happened, is like he was the smarty pants who got the rights early. Yeah. I mean, correctly, because I remember reading that blog when I was like 12, very popular blog at the time. This horror movie, which is entirely original, he wrote it and directed it himself. And the premise is that the main characters are a young couple who travel around rural Ireland recording audio recordings of obscure Irish folk songs. And they do so because there is a thriving black market for songs that no one else has heard.
So great.
It's not surreal in tone. It's just that there's this one piece of world building that you have to just accept that exists, which is something I really love. One of my favorite examples of this is the Cronenberg movie Crimes of the Future from a couple of years ago, which is based all around a subculture of people who love recreational surgery. Obviously, that's a much more peculiar style of film, but I really love when a movie just makes up a subculture that just couldn't possibly exist, but it works because, like, obviously there are rich people who will pay for really obscure stuff, like, you know, weird truffles. So why wouldn't they spend money on a folk song that no one's ever heard before?
Why not?
Like, the young woman is a young Irish woman, which is how they get their in with a lot of these people in these quite secluded rural communities. And her boyfriend, who is this Russian guy, who is played by an Irish actor doing a Russian accent, which is like a little dubious, but like, whatever. Apparently they just did it so like they'd be able to differentiate between the characters really easily, which it was like such a funny logistical reason. Like, the Q&A after this was like people asking all these questions about the film's themes, and then the director being like, that was not a theme, I just did this for some pragmatic reason because this film cost £10. And it was like, love you. I don't want to give away too much about what happens in this, but it's an extremely kind of well-constructed folk horror story. And for people who are maybe not super into horror, this is probably still a good choice of movie because it's not the type of film where you're really scared and there's a lot of big fright scenes or particularly gory. It's more in the sort of neo-fantasy realm. It's sort of a mystery story. It's quite genre bending because the premise is all about folk music, and it's very based around entertaining naturalistic dialogue. Like, the way he sets up people's conversations is very well illustrated, and you can also kind of see the skill set that he's got as a documentary filmmaker, because the main characters are people who have to have the social confidence but also the kind of slight amorality to really pressure themselves into situations where they can get people to do stuff they wouldn't otherwise do. They are essentially kind of stealing people's art and culture, which is the backbone of a lot of kind of folk horror stories, because it's about, you know, there's a lot of kind of colonialism subtext going on there as well, obviously, because it's like these are stories that should be private to their communities, but they're being sold off to rich people. I don't want to go into any further details, but it's really fun. I did feel like the first half was kind of a bit better than the second half, but once again, that might be because I was watching a late night screening on a weeknight when I'd been doing a bunch of work. The music is, of course, fucking great. The music is by Lancome, a modern original folk band. If you've heard any of their music, you'll kind of know it.
Such a great choice.
Yeah, it's so good. I would actually love to interview them about this movie, because it's like, it's one of those films where obviously, when you make a film that's about a fictional piece of art, it has to really hit, and it really hits. Because when you hear the song that the movie is kind of hinging on, like, my hair was standing on end. It's not kind of performed in a typical way. It's not like they play a song, you know, it's like they have someone who's sort of like an atypical performer, and that's just, and that's how folk music should work, because it's the whole point of the story is it's the music of the people rather than the music of performance. Yeah, it's so fun. All You Need Is Death. It's going to be released pretty soon. It was a small production, and it's just like, it's won attention just because it's good. It's good and it's original.
Yay. No, I'm excited to see that for sure.
All right. I think that's all of our movies.
Yeah.
The Glasgow Film Festival.
A good selection.
Yeah. Got all the genres in there, many different nationalities. So we'll be back quite soon. Next episode should be on the sitcom Upright with Stefan. And then Claire and I will be back with an episode, a Patreon request on the action thriller Hannah, starring Saoirse Ronan and Cate Blanchett, which is a personal favourite of mine. So I'm very excited to talk about that.
I'm excited to watch
it. I hope you like it. It's got banging costumes. It's really fun. And it's got an original soundtrack by the Chemical Brothers. Because almost all action movies are big blockbusters, it really shows like what you can do in an action movie on a lower budget, not in the sort of martial arts sense, but just as this kind of original piece of storytelling. Like, it's by Joe Wright, who made Pride and Prejudice, and it's so wild to consider, like, the filmography this man has had. Recently, not been so good, but he was like, I'm just going to take a little break here and make an action movie starring teenage Saoirse Ronan. And it fucking slaps. That and the sitcom Upright with Stefan. And awesome. If you've not heard it yet, go check out our previous podcast on Dune Part 2.
Yeah. A very fun one.
Okay, Claire, where can folks find you on social media?
You can find me at Ms. Claire Biddles on both Twitter and Blue Sky, and I'm just Claire Biddles, all one word, on Letterboxd.
Cool. I'm Letterboxd Hello Taylor, Gabby at Blue Sky, still kind of on Twitter at Hello_Taylor. And obviously you can find the show notes to this episode at overinvestedpodcast.com. You can support the podcast and get some exclusive Patreon content at patreon.com/overinvestedpodcast. So thanks for listening, and we'll see you all soon. Bye-bye.